Hi there, I'm Georgie Ainsley, and every week I talk to someone who is a performance person. They could be an athlete from the world of entertainment, business, or politics. They could even be an astronaut. The key link is, of course, that they all know how to perform at the top level, and they can teach us all a thing or two about how to do that in our own lives, at whatever it is that we do. Performance People is available wherever you get your podcasts, or of course, you can watch us on YouTube, where you can also subscribe, and please do. Anna West, founder of Sleep to Perform, works with leading sports teams and businesses across Europe. She helps individuals and groups to peak by understanding their sleep patterns, its correlation to circadian rhythm, stress levels, and lifestyle choices so they can become better sleepers. She's not interested in a quick fix, but long-lasting results, and provides a toolkit which you can utilize immediately for better sleep. Anna, this is precisely the right time for me to be having this conversation with you. I'm off the back of back-to-back weekend nights where the children didn't sleep and therefore neither did I. Talk to me about why sleep is so important to all of us. It seems like a really elementary question, but there must be a lot of stuff that you can put behind that.
I mean, you just said it. When we don't sleep, we feel like we function less optimal. So in that sense, sleep is a foundation of well-being. Sleep is a foundation of us being able to deliver the performance we want to. And I think in general, what you can say is that sleep is the precondition for life in many senses. But that being said, it's also important to underline that we can do quite well without longer periods of poor sleep or with periods of poor sleep.
So can you tell me about the best version of a sleep cycle, what that should look like? What is an optimal sleep cycle supposed to look like for those of us who all crave it?
Well, many people crave it, so you're not the only one. And statistically, we know today that a lot of people aren't getting sufficient hours of sleep, and the quality of the sleep that they're getting is actually quite low as well. I tend to not talk about optimal because there's a quite high degree of creating sleep anxiety. We always try to strive for something which is not reachable, and life very often comes in the way of optimal sleep. So if we look at the World Health Organization, they would recommend that a healthy adult sleeps between 7 to 9 hours per night, uninterrupted sleep. And when was the last time you did that?
About 1999.
Exactly. So when I speak about sleep, and look, of course, we need to preach what we know science has concluded, but we also sometimes need to translate the science into the reality that people are living in. So I try to tend not to talk too much about the duration of the sleep. Not that it's not important, but sometimes it's not possible for us to get the duration that we should have. So I'd rather speak about the quality that we should embed into our sleep, which comes from a lot of good routines that people tend to forget. Remember that theoretically we're born to sleep, and then we do everything in our power to mess up that opportunity for the body as soon as we get out of bed. So, of course, optimal sleep would be you sleeping between these 7 to 9 hours uninterrupted every night, which means that you can't have children, you can't have a busy life, you can't travel, you can't do exercise, you can't do. So I'd much rather speak about what habits that leads to the optimized opportunity of getting the higher sleep output.
Okay, let's do exactly that then. So what are those habits, and how can we achieve that part?
I usually say that a good night's sleep starts when you wake up in the morning, right? So in theory, you prepare the body throughout the whole day to use that sleep window that you want to utilize during the night. And a good example is that the better we exploit daylight, the better that we actually accept that we are still working as cave women and cavemen, that has a circadian rhythm inside our body, which is responding to light, the better we will create the opportunity. Like, no human being was born to stay the whole day inside an artificial light. So a good way to start creating a positive sleep opportunity is actually to get up in the morning, make sure you get outside, get some proper daylight, make sure you not exercise, but that you move the body. If you take the picture of a caveman or a cavewoman, we didn't just like wake up, fall out of bed, like accidentally fell into the fridge where we had like, or the water tap where we had, like, we actually had to do a little bit of an exercise to get those things covered for us, which meant that we had to go out of a dark cave into the light. We had to walk to get the food. We had to walk to get the water. So if we apply some of that basic knowledge, to be honest, around how we actually live, I usually say like, get a dog. Like in today's like society, just get a dog, because it forces you to go, I have a dog. So it forces you to get up in the morning, get outside, get some of that like low level exercise, and then natural daylight as well. So a good place to start is to actually make sure that you follow the light of the day.
Good box tick for me, because I've got two dogs, but I know exactly what you mean about that. A morning walk with both of those dogs sets me up really, really well for the day. And I think it's not just because I know that I've done a job. It is because, like you've said, I'm out in the fresh air, taking in the light, absorbing that. And it definitely has this energizing effect on you, for sure. Why do you think we don't prioritize? Go on, you say.
No, it was just going back to your point. I think it's also because you give yourself the mental space to actually allow the day to start a little bit slower. If that makes sense. So today, when we wake up, we're exposed to this tsunami of information from our phones, from all the different social media platforms that we attach to, from the news, et cetera, et cetera. And quite often, if we do an old fashioned walk, we actually allow the system to wake up at a lower pace, which is also a more comfortable way for the body to actually wake up in the morning. So rather than us, it's a little bit like compared to a pulse, like it's much nicer for a pulse to increase gradually than go from 0 to 100. And in that sense, you're waking up the body in a more natural way, which is the way that the body was actually built to be woken up.
Why don't we prioritize sleep more? I mean, it's everywhere telling us, people, you know, like you and lots of very learned people saying, come on, sleep really matters. It can make you do extraordinary things. Why is it that it's such an aside with so many of us, and we don't put it as a fundamental of everyday life that can actually can change the goalposts? It can shift stuff, a good night's sleep.
I actually understand why people don't prioritize it, because ultimately we in theory do nothing when we sleep, right? And in a fast-paced world where we need to tick off a lot of boxes, in a way sleep can also be linked to laziness, right? When we today, and it's changing definitely, but if you go back in time, you were a little bit of a warrior if you could claim that you could survive on 5 hours of sleep per night, that, you know, you everyone has heard about that neighbor or that grandpa who could always survive on five hours of sleep. Today, we know that we can't, that the body's simply not built to function like that. We can do that in periods of time, and then ultimately we will have to pay a price for it. Today, we don't prioritize it, I think, for two reasons, because the world is not built around sleep. The world today is built around being awake. But I do see that there's a shift in the perception of what sleep does, because it's also more and more accepted that breaks lead to productivity. So it's also quite environmental. It depends on where you are. If you look, I do some quite interesting projects in very like hardcore environments, both performance-wise and like sports-wise, but also like corporate performance-wise. And if the perception of us being able to deliver high results is dependent on undermining sleep as much as possible, we have a clash, right? But if we are in environments where we actually understand that the sleep becomes a precondition for us to enhance performance, suddenly sleep is a part of our performance enhancement strategy. And sometimes in elite sports, it's a little bit more eatable. Because we know that there's a strong link between poor sleep and increase of, or the risk of injuries. We know that there's a quite high link between demotivation, poor sleep, et cetera, et cetera. So it's a little bit more measurable when we are working with sleep in an elite sports environment, as opposed to in corporate environments. And the big difference is also when you are a sports person, everything you do become a part of the asset that you are. Whereas in a private corporate setting, sleep is something that you do in your private domain and you're not necessarily an asset to the organization.
I think that's brilliantly surmised, because when I look at my husband and I think there are so many learnings you can take, he's an elite sports person. And I think the amount of learnings you can take from him and his world into the wider world, and like you say, a corporate or a business world, are extraordinary. But one of them fundamentally is the basics of sleep, which can in sport terms become this huge marginal gain, as you've just described. I completely understand where you're coming from when you say that. You've worked with a number of elite sports teams, and I know you have this sort of traffic light system when you assess them. Just tell me a bit about that and how that works.
So basically today you can screen people in a quite big array of ways to determine whether or not the sleep output is positive. So when I start to work with anyone, whether it's an elite sports person or someone in a high level corporate organization, I put them into a traffic light, not necessarily to determine if they don't have an opportunity, but to determine a little bit more where are they in regards to that opportunity. So let's say a football player who has a very low duration of sleep, very poor quality of sleep, it becomes a little bit of a business case as well, because if we have that factored into his performance regime, we also know that there's a higher risk of a burnout, of injury, et cetera. So it needs to be something that we apply to treat, if that makes sense. But if I have a green profile who's actually doing quite well, who needs a little bit of nudging or hacking here and there, it becomes an opportunity to harvest margins, like you said before. And the traffic light system allows me, or the screening that I'm doing allows me to basically put them into a box from where we can create the intervention, which will then squeeze margins or actually save him from very poor sleep, which is then putting him into a risk zone.
I suppose when it comes to green, you can always improve, can't you? Even if you're a green on the traffic light system, according to Anna West, you can always be better than that.
But the thing is, I try really not to preach in my mythology. I actually try to embrace the factual truth that very often elite sports and sleep does not go hand in hand. Like take Premier League football, Champions League football, where I'm working the majority of my time. We will have late kickoff times where we will have the most viewers, which means that it goes completely against normal sleep physiology or human physiology, because we don't want a big light exposure when we are going to sleep. We don't want caffeine. We don't want the adrenaline running in our system. So a football player is doing everything in his power to work against sleep. And then at the same time, we're telling him that he needs to sleep to avoid injuries. So I actually have a quite big responsibility in preaching the right knowledge so that I also don't breed like sleep anxiety, because a lot of people like from my field came into sports and then we started speaking about, you know, if we don't sleep, we'll see injured players, which means that we're actually breeding, or we are actually creating a potential problem so that they can't fall asleep because they start to fear the fact that they can't really sleep and they need the sleep. So that was why I said I never preach optimal. I preach around how we can optimize, which I think is extremely important, because sleep is extremely multidisciplinary as well. And it's dependent on a lot of factors. As I said before, a good night's sleep starts when you wake up in the morning, which means that a lot of the strategies that will be applied around an athlete or a corporate person throughout the day, a lot of the choices that he or she will make will ultimately create the opportunity for sleep at night. And a good example would be a corporate guy who sits in front of his laptop the whole day. He doesn't move, he doesn't get outside. So already there, we're minimizing the opportunity for sleep. But at the same time, you might have an athlete who's like extremely active outside the whole day, but he doesn't have a break where the adrenaline and the cortisol level can drop down. So he will spike and he'll be quite stressed before he goes to bed. He also doesn't create necessarily a good sleep opportunity for himself. So it's about understanding your own pattern and how that pattern is actually leading or minimizing opportunity to optimize but not create optimal, because sleep very often doesn't allow optimal.
So I've looked at what the key factors are according to you with regards to you know, how you can change the conversation around your sleep with habits. And I've written down some things: diet, alcohol, napping, yes, light, sleep hygiene. And what was the last one? And emotional, which is, you sort of talked about the sort of stress side of that just a moment ago. Can we take them each in their own isolation and work through them? Because I think people will really resonate with one or two or many of these. Perhaps diet, first of all. How crucial is it to do the right thing by your body, by your system, thinking of the circadian rhythm as well, ahead of going to sleep?
So I very often get the question about sleep nutrition, right? What should I eat before I go to bed to optimize my opportunity to sleep? And I say, look, it's not what you eat right before you go to bed that creates the opportunity, because you could eat like junk food throughout the whole day, but then you eat the right nutrients just before you go to bed, and then you didn't really create the opportunity. So for me, sleep and nutrition go very, very much hand in hand when you apply an all-round nutritional plan around yourself, meaning that if you don't eat for a longer period of time and then you all of a sudden eat something because you're craving food, your blood sugar levels are going to spike, which means that you're producing a lot more stress hormone. The challenge about that is then you have a higher level of stress hormone, and then the body can't really produce melatonin, which is the sleep hormone, when you have to go to bed. On the other hand, if you have a leveled nutrition and you have control about these blood sugar levels throughout the day, you leave an opportunity for the body to produce sufficient melatonin, which is the hormone which makes you fall asleep and stay asleep. So it goes hand in hand. And there will be, to be honest, research around nutrition and sleep is very multifaceted. And there's a lot of belief in X, Y, Z components that you can put in, but it's also very blurry, to be honest. And especially in elite sports, because there will be things where we know that it can promote sleep. But then let's say you're a football player on match day minus one, where you need to load carbohydrate because you're going into competition the next day after. In an ideal world, you would have loaded protein. But because we need to think about the match situation, we're actually going against. So sometimes it's a little bit individual where we can harvest. But what I would say is that nutrition and sleep are very interlinked, but it's not what you eat just before you go to bed. A good example, which is a little bit linked to it as well, is that hydration plays a massive role in our ability to sleep. The thing is just that we don't want people to overhydrate in the evening, because then ultimately they have to go to the toilet 2, 3, 4 times during the night, and then they break their own sleep cycle. So if you focus only on being hydrated, but you forget the mechanism about hydration and having to go to the toilet, it's a lose-lose situation. So a good example, so if you're not hydrated well enough, and here's a hack for everyone listening in. The thing is, again, your pulse level will rise and your blood pressure will rise, which will then make it more difficult for the body to create enough or sufficient melatonin. So a sleep hack is actually to make sure that you hydrate well enough throughout the day, leading to the sleep opportunity at night.
That makes perfect sense. We all just have to put it into practice. Now, alcohol is a funny one, because how many times have you heard people say, oh, I sleep so much better after a glass or two of wine? That is, I suspect, a commonly held myth, and not at all true. I mean, I know just from wearing one of these, I'm showing you my Aura ring at the minute. Whenever I look at my Aura ring after I've had a couple of glasses of wine at a very nice dinner somewhere or whatever, and not strictly behave myself where alcohol's concerned, my HPV scores are crazily bad. I mean, is that a common
problem?
Your
resting heart rate goes up. The thing is that we can all relate. Look, I'm not a saint here. I drink alcohol as well. I just do it purposeful, if that makes sense. So I know when to drink it, and I know when not to drink it, because I understand the mechanism behind it. The thing is about alcohol, I would say that it's most likely the most misunderstood sleeping drug on the market, to be honest, right? Because it makes us sleepy. So when we drink alcohol, we get tired, but the process that follows in the slipstream of having an alcohol intake is that it completely messes up your sleep, right? Alcohol contains alcohol, a lot of calories, and when we when we drink it in the evening before we go to bed, we actually get tired, but it's a little bit like putting gas on a fire that we want to turn off. So the body starts to burn all of these calories. Your blood pressure increases again, your pulse level. I'm sure when you look at your aura data, what you'll see is also that your resting heart rate, not only your HRV is dropping down, but your resting heart rate goes up. Mm. And it's basically because you're asking your body to go like full spin, full power at a point in time where you actually want to go to sleep. The brain responds a little bit differently because it gets like sedated by the alcohol. That's why you feel tired. So alcohol is absolutely a no-go if you have sleeping problems, because it's not going to resolve the problem. It's going to make the problem worse. If I took you to a sleep lab and I would do measurements, and I would see how it affected your like overall sleep cycle. So when we sleep in a sleep cycle of 90 minutes, around 90 minutes. And during that sleep cycle, we go through different phases of sleep. And the very common question is someone saying, oh, I heard that deep sleep is the most important part. And just like to demystify, every sleep phase has an impact on you, and every sleep phase is important. And alcohol messes up basically every phase, if that makes sense. So if you see your data at the back of a night with alcohol, you will be reduced in the output on more or less everything, to be honest.
Okay, good to know. Napping.
The only place where you Yeah, no, the only place where you might see actually an increase is that it can make you fall asleep quicker if you have problems falling asleep, but it's not a solution.
No, and it's not gonna give you a good night's sleep. That's fundamental.
No.
What about napping? Because I have friends that somehow manage to nap everywhere and anywhere in any situation, whether it's noisy around them or not. They are absolutely fine with just falling asleep right then and there. I've never been able to do that. Yeah. Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
It's debatable, right? Because it's a little bit down to, so if you're someone who can literally put your head on the ground and fall asleep, I would say that it's a sign of sleep deprivation, right? That your body's like seeking the opportunity at every given opportunity, which means that there's a deficit, like you're lacking. So the body's craving it. It's a little bit like if you don't sleep, what we see is also that it affects your appetite. And if you're sleep deprived, like you just told me that you are today, and if I took you into a brain scanner and I showed you pictures of, I don't know, broccoli versus chocolate, your brain would just like buzz up when I showed you the chocolate, because you're lacking energy and your brain will go for the energy. So with napping, it's a little bit the same. If you create an opportunity for the body to relax and fall asleep, if you're in a deficit, it will try to fall asleep. It will seek the sleep. Napping can be exceptionally powerful, especially cognitively, if you know how to do it in the right way. And I usually say it's a little bit like the quick program on a dishwasher, right? You can do like the full program. We want that to happen at night, but you can also do like the quick program in the middle of the day where you literally just like cognitively clean up and you bring energy back into the system. The thing is that you need to be quite good at timing when you do it and how long you do it for. Because if you wake up in the middle of a sleep cycle, which would be like the 90 minutes, you will feel more like knackered after than actually before the nap. But if you sleep, and scientifically I'm supposed to say, like, if you sleep now between or below 26 minutes, the body will not start to descend into the deeper sleep phases and you will wake up refreshed. I'm not that rigid, so I usually try to say to people, like, just try to keep it around 25 minutes. Set an alarm. Don't debate with yourself. When the alarm goes off, like, you don't snooze, you literally get up. It's non-negotiable. And then the first couple of times where you do like a shorter nap, it feels like I hit you in the head with a hammer. Like, honestly, you won't necessarily like it. But when you train, because sleep is a little bit like going to the gym. The first time you go to the gym, you don't necessarily build muscle just because you lift something, right? But when you repeat and when you're consistent, the system will follow along. And sleep is all about hormones and all about like mental attitude as well. So the more you train and the more you create patterns in your system, the more you will also see a positive output.
Now, one of the things that you've got on your list is light, which I think is really interesting because we talked earlier about the circadian rhythm and the caveman, cavewoman thing of, you know, getting up with the dawn and going to bed with the dusk. And that absolutely makes perfect sense. Funnily enough, when you're raising children, the commonly held belief or maybe misbelief is that, you know, a night light on will soothe them and get them to sleep nicely and this, that and the other. I have found that that is always a disaster if I don't remember to switch it off at some point during the night. But from reading up about the stuff that you've been talking about, is there something more behind that? It feels like actually it's their version of a blue light that's just a total disaster for just consistency of sleep to have that light on permanently.
The disaster is that, again, you have to remember, like, if you go back millions of years in history, like, a lot of things didn't really evolve in our system, but the world around us evolved. So we are exposed to a lot more light today than we were going back in time. And where light becomes disastrous is if we're exposed to it at the wrong time compared to that existent old circadian rhythm that actually lives in our system. So a good example would be if I take high level sports. So let's take a football player who returns back from a late night match. A disaster would be that he turns like on all the spots in the ceiling and he continues to get that light exposure, because if he does the opposite and only turns on indirect light, that lumi, like the sensitivity of the light intensity, will signal to him that he needs, or the body needs, to start to shut down. If we continue like 24/7 all the time to have like very high light exposure, the brain gets confused. And when we have a very high light exposure, in a very simplified way, what happens is that the body continues to produce energy hormones. So let's say that we expose our kids to high light exposure like all the time, and especially just before they go to bed. It's a little bit like putting heavy metal into their ears when you want them to relax. Because the body gets confused about what to do when, which means that they will most likely produce less of the sleep hormone and more of the energy hormone. So yes, yeah. Light has a major impact.
What about
I'm sure that there are some light architects that would agree. See a very big business in this. But definitely today, like if you go into very advanced hotels or hospital facilities, you can really manipulate with light. I did a few years back a quite interesting study with a hospital ward where we were manipulating the light to see if we could get doctors and nurses who were leaving a night shift to sleep better if we manipulated the light, so that rather than them leaving the night shift with the light being intensified, what we did during the night shift was actually to decrease the intensity of the light, so that when they left the ward, it was a little bit like nighttime for them and they were wearing sunglasses, and we could see that the sleep latency, the time they spent to fall asleep, actually reduced and they slept longer and the quality of the sleep came better.
Wow. Climate and sleep hygiene. I was reading up about this and thought this is rather amusing, but at the same time would resonate with people. You know, where temperature is concerned, and I completely get this, sort of opening a window before bed and just having that sort of fresh air breathe through and making sure it's just not too hot in your sleeping environment. I think we sort of all probably know that's what we should be doing. But even it comes down, especially with you and your work with elite footballers, to what you're wearing in bed. So sleeping naked or sleeping in cotton or sleeping in bamboo, or what is the best thing you can do for yourself in terms of what you wear in bed? Should you wear clothes or not?
It's a little bit of a difficult one, to be honest. I'm a quite firm believer in wearing a textile which supports thermoregulation, which means that it supports your development of temperature throughout the night. So when we sleep during the night, the temperature will have a tendency to actually go a bit up and down. Some women, especially people like women in the menopause, and not to neglect the men because they have it a lot as well, they will have some quite significant spikes on their temperature. And then you will not necessarily feel it as you waking up, but your body is waking up and you start to toss and turn when it becomes too warm, which is fragmenting your sleep. So you might wake up the next day feeling like, ooh, I'm not really energized. In theory, it's because you've been tossing and turning to try to find a spot where your body was not overheating. So a little bit like we are investing a lot of money in dry fit material when we're doing sports, because we want that sweat to be taken away from our body. And yeah. we are not like, no one today would be training in a cotton t-shirt, because we know that it's quite uncomfortable long term, because it becomes wet and it becomes heavy. So I usually say, so why would you sleep in it? Right? We invest a lot of, and this is going back to the investment in sleep, because we invest a lot of money in our like measurable performance, what we can see. And people tend to forget to invest just as much in the sleep and recovery, which is a precondition for them to be able to perform the next day. So I did a study some years back as well, also in a football club. And we literally just took the squad, divided them into two, and we asked half of them just to wear whatever they usually would wear. And then we asked, and this is a long time ago, we just asked them to wear like dry fit material. And what we could see is that the ones sleeping in a dry fit material that could support the regulation of the temperature slept significantly better than the ones sleeping naked or in a dry fit material. It's not only what you sleep in, but it's also your duvet. It's also what you put around your duvet. And for me, it's a little bit about getting people to understand that is an investment area as well. You can have like crazy expensive running shoes, and then you have a crappy pillow from somewhere. Or you can have like, again, the most advanced tracking system, but then you're sleeping with a duvet and your temperature in the bedroom is 24 degrees. And basically you're not harvesting the opportunity of performance enhancement because you're not recovering well. Because we have to remember, so during sleep, one thing is that we go through these different sleep phases. But it's also during sleep that you create the hormones that rebuild the body. So your growth hormone, your testosterone, everything which is rebuilding muscle. When we train, we basically destroy the muscle so that they can rebuild and become stronger. So if we don't sleep well, what happens is actually that process is also minimized. So you should invest just as much in your recovery and sleep as you're actually investing in your performance. I'm like overselling my topic here, but it's actually true.
No, it goes back to reprioritizing and putting sleep as a fundamental part of that whole journey. Finally, about the emotional piece, because that's the other point here that you mentioned briefly earlier about this as well, the sort of anxiety bit. What I wanted to ask you was, are you a fan or not a fan of sleep tracking devices? Because I've heard so many people talk about them in positive lights, and so many people also say, actually, it just gave me even more reason to stress out about my lack or my belief that I wasn't getting the best possible quality sleep.
I'm a believer and a fan if the tracking device is used in the right way. I'm absolutely not a believer in the tracking device being the solution, but I'm a believer in the tracking device being used in a sensible way, being a part of a motivation that can that can place you somewhere on a journey. Again, I'm very often working in environments where we're like talking about margins, and in those cases, I'm not always a super fan of the trackers and the wearable devices, because it can stress it tremendously if you see that your data is not where you want them to be. At the same time, I'm working with a little bit of a different angle, because I want to build up resilience in the sense that, look, when we are in elite sports, we can't expect that our data will always be green. So I actually want to have coping mechanisms so that we can make ourselves believe that we can actually deliver, even though we still see red data. So I'm not always using the tracking device in the sense that the private person would use it, because let's be honest, or your case for that matter, you've had a few days where you didn't sleep because of kids. That doesn't mean that you can't survive from now on. It means that you need to have like a toolbox in your backpack of stuff that you know, okay, I slept poorly, so what do I do today to support myself in the best way? Okay, you need to be sufficient around hydration. You need to be a little bit smarter about getting the daylight so that you prepare the next night to be a little bit better than the night before. So I do believe that tracking devices can be extremely good to kind of support education as well, so that when we are applying interventions, we can see if they have an effect or not. And I'm a strong believer in not a one size fits all, because again, going back to the emotional part, you might react to something in one way, and then I'm working with someone and they might react to something in a different way. Be sensible. I think that's my message around the tracking device, especially also because the quality of the data that you get can vary a lot, which means that you might have a really, really big, significant, deficit in your data. You might wear something and it tells you, well, you slept like really poorly. And in reality, you actually slept better. So what do you believe, the poor data or the feeling that it's actually left in your body? Because quite often we can also be persuaded into believing, oh, I feel like crap because the data told me that now I'm supposed to feel like crap. Yeah. So when I'm working with devices, I have a tendency to actually get to a point where I ask the people that I work with to take them off.
Wow. What point is that in the sleep assessment? Straight away?
No, not necessarily. But the beauty of my job and where I feel quite privileged is that I get to work with people quite long term, which means that I also get to see fluctuation. It can be in elite sports like competition season, off season, injury period, you name it. And it depends on the personality. But if I see anyone start to obsess around the data, that's absolutely a breaking point for me to take away the device, because we don't want the obsession. We want to create a sustainable solution. We want to motivate, but we don't want to create any level of like fanatic attitude towards sleep as well, because that can really backfire over time.
What is the one thing that you've learned more than anything else in all the years you've been assessing various different elite people in their worlds where sleep's concerned?
I love it. I actually really love the question. I think that it's people like me who come from a quite boxed thinking scientific world. We need to be extremely good advocates of translating our knowledge into different environments, and us having the respect that our science might say A, but we are the ones who are responsible of translating that in the correct way into that environment that we are going into. Because there's a tremendously big difference between working with an extreme sport guy. I did a project a few years back with an extreme sport guy who's doing like, he did something called Yukon Arctic Circle Race, which is like 400 miles across ice. He runs with a gun and he brings his own supply. There would be like ice, but like everything works against sleep. And in his case, it's all about like optimizing these very small windows of sleep that he's allowed to get. So I need to adapt my knowledge to his challenge. So when I go into one environment, that's my role, that we can't apply a one size fits all model around sleep, because environments are extremely different. And you asked about the emotional environment, and the emotional state of an environment plays a major role in sleep as well. So I think the biggest learning is adaptation in order to create success.
And finally, a performance tip for everyday people. So with everything that you have learned from elite sport, what can regular people take into their lives every single day that will give them a better shot at a better night's sleep? What's the one thing that you would tell them to do on a daily basis?
To be honest, if you went on Google, right, and you Google like the five best tips around sleep, I think tip number one would still be like create sleep regularity, which is bollocks in elite sports, right? Because quite often you won't have a frequent schedule. So if you have the opportunity, and I understand why Google would put that on top of the list, because that creates predictability in your system and it makes it a lot easier for your hormones. If you have an opportunity to create some sustainable scheduling around your sleep, that would be my tip number one. The second one is don't underestimate the effect of sleep hygiene. Today, we live in extremely modern housing. We live in very isolated houses. And a lot of people, like in Germany, the latest statistic that came out was that 37% of the population, they sleep in two warm bedrooms. So they don't have a sleeping problem, but they are creating a sleeping problem because of the environment that they're sleeping in. So sleep hygiene, making sure that Sleep hygiene is not only the temperature in the bedroom. Sleep hygiene is also that you allow your body to prepare to go into the sleep phase. So if I asked you, I'm hoping you would say yes, but you brush your teeth every night, right? Because it gives you a pleasant feeling, and you've done it always, and you don't put too much mind power into doing it. And usually I try to communicate it as create some toothbrushes, like the things that you just do every day without you putting too much mind power into it. But know that that would be habits that ultimately creates a better opportunity for you to sleep. Again, a toothbrush would be like just every day, just don't turn on like very intensive light before you go to bed. A toothbrush would be just air your room. Like don't negotiate it. Just do it. Hydration, like don't negotiate it. Just make sure you hydrate well, because you're creating opportunity every time you have these small toothbrushes. And I think a third one would be, remember to apply what you would apply around the car. Like when you throughout the day, it's absolutely okay that you drive with 200 kilometers an hour on the highway, but none of you guys listening in, or you for that matter, would try to park your car with the same speed, right? You would remove the foot from the speeder to make sure that you can, in a very secure way, get your car into the booth. Today, people tend to forget that the body needs that we remove the foot from the speeder so that we pace down before we go to bed. We expect that we can just like run with 200 kilometers per hour, hit the pillow and then fall asleep. And the body was not built to do that. So that's an advice as well.
I have absolutely loved this conversation, Anna. It's been so, so interesting. And you've confirmed a bunch of stuff to me, which is good to hear again, because it just reiterates what you already know, but it's said in such a powerful way. But also I've learned loads. So thank you so much. It's been really, really interesting.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.